The energy industry reaches a historic breakthrough that may change the world forever. This is Brief Before Impact. Welcome, everyone. I am Matt Parker. Thank you for joining me. This is the last episode before Christmas 2022. I wish you all a very Merry Christmas, and hopefully with your friends and families, you can celebrate the reason for the season, giving and time together, as well as bringing in the new year with big hopes for you all. So, Merry Christmas and Happy Holidays. Today's brief is going to be discussing a historic breakthrough in the energy industry. The issue of fusion energy has finally been seen a tremendous change in what could be a large impact on how mankind can harness energy in the coming decades. Still lots of work to be done. However, this is a tremendous breakthrough, and we're going to break down all that to include the recent breakthroughs with fusion energy, the history of fusion energy, and lastly, some geopolitical implications. Before we get into all of it, let me just take a quick ad break, and then we will get to work. All right, welcome back, everyone. So let's break down the recent breakthrough and discuss kind of the details. And this is according to reporting from Inverse.com. This past week, in a historic first, the team at Lawrence Livermore National Laboratory's National Ignition Facility announced that they managed to create a surplus of nuclear fusion energy by bombarding hydrogen isotopes with powerful lasers. Now, scientists, clean energy advocates, and closely following nerds around the world are wondering what's next. The biggest question is, when will it help supply clean energy to our homes and businesses? In order for nuclear fusion energy, which is an emissions-free and potentially abundant source of power, to supply the country with electricity, we would need power plants to scale up production and provide a consistent stream of juice. So now, months before scientists actually managed to achieve a net gain in fusion energy, the White House had already outlined a plan to get such a plant up and running within the next decade. But is that possible? Well, it depends on who you ask. To paint a picture of our readers, Inverse magazine talked to three different nuclear fusion experts about the long path ahead towards power plants. So let's first answer this question of what advantage does nuclear fusion have over other renewables? So we might be wondering how nuclear fusion power compares to things, sources like solar or wind or even geothermal. Unlike some of these forms of power, it can be deployed where and when you need it, says Troy Carter, a plasma physicist at the University of California, Los Angeles. The ingredients can be sourced around the world. There's a lot of hydrogen isotope deuterium in seawater and freshwater, and lithium from seawater can be used to make the isotope tritium. Just looking at seawater, there's enough fusion fuel to power all of humanity's needs for hundreds of thousands of years, Carter says. Nuclear fusion plants could also operate more often compared to other forms of clean energy that depend on sun or windy days to collect power. Overall, though, all these renewables could complement each other to ensure an emissions-free future. All solutions could be explored, according to Michael Cuneo, the electrical engineer at the Sandia National Laboratories in Albuquerque, New Mexico. So the question now becomes, what would a nuclear fusion plant look like? Well, it could look something similar to today's nuclear power plants in terms of its size and infrastructure, says Arania Gleason, a scientist at the Department of Energy, SLAC National Oscillatory Laboratory. There, the process of nuclear fission forces uranium atoms to split apart and generate energy, essentially the opposite of nuclear fusion, which combines hydrogen isotopes. Cuneo agrees that the fission power plants are at least in the ballpark of what to expect, the cost, the look, the feel. They have all the basic components and have a nuclear island to provide the heat. It's currently unclear whether power plants will rely on laser techniques or magnetic confinement, a process where devices use magnetic fields to trap hydrogen isotopes so that they warm up to temperatures required to trigger fusion. LLNL director Kim Boodle noted in a recent press conference that this technology is further ahead in research and perhaps closer to commercialization. Ultimately, though, power plants could utilize some sort of combination of both. Overall, a range of ideas is currently swirling around. As for what these plants could actually power, Gleason says that labs at the Department of Energy and at universities are focusing on developing sources of energy that can be widely used in electric grids. Cuneo also thinks nuclear fusion energy should be sent to the grid. Quote, if the entire transportation sector becomes electrified to move away from fossil fuels, as we should, electric generation capacity might need to triple, he says. Quote, any growth in electrical generation capacity must be green and cannot be from fossil fuels. Fusion is one option that must be developed. End quote. As for the other specific uses, Carter notes that fusion power could be used to produce hydrogen, a fuel that could accelerate the transition towards electric vehicles. So, how much, in fact, will nuclear fusion power plant cost? Future research and development could cost tens of billions of dollars, Gleason estimates. So far, most nuclear fusion research has focused on scientific proof of concept work, and very little funding has been available to actually develop the technology involved, Cuneo says. Quote, it is difficult to be specific on the cost of technology development program. There are a lot of problems to solve the technology to be developed and mature. The problems are also difficult, and they aren't just engineering, end quote. Still, Carter points out nuclear fusion must compete with the price of other types of energy, which means that both the private and public sector needs to invest for it to succeed. And in recent years, investors have poured nearly $5 billion into fusion startups. So the White House has ambitions, and the question is their 2032 fusion plant goal realistic? The question becomes, when can we get electricity from nuclear fusion plants? The White House plan announced this March will devote $50 million to fusion research in hopes of building a pilot plant in 10 years. But not everyone is convinced that that vision is realistic. Quote, unfortunately, no, as a history and fusion research shows. But this is just my opinion, Cuneo says. 10 years is very little time. It's still a good vision to invest more in this technology and others to go faster. Even if things do work out on a time scale, it usually takes around 40 to 50 years to widely adopt a new source of energy. 40 to 50 years. Carter is more optimistic about 2032 deadline and adds that the recent scientific breakthroughs like the NIF result could put researchers in a position to deploy fusion quickly enough to mitigate the impacts of climate change. Carter says it will take hard work and innovation, but this is what we do in the United States, so I think it's possible to meet this goal, and the fusion research community is ready to roll up our sleeves and make it happen. So that is the overall gist of what's going on inside of this development with fusion energy. So now that we kind of have the bullet points of what's happening with this development and fusion energy, I thought it was quite fascinating just looking back at some of the history and the development of this technology, because frankly, I didn't know a lot of it. And it turns out that the process of fusion energy has been around for decades now. It's just that they were able to harness it in such a way that we can now produce energy in a meaningful way to actually support our just daily lives. And let me kind of give you the background what I'm talking about. Again, according to Inverse.com, the reporting is that hot fusion and the Cold War actually coincided in terms of the time frame. Back in 1958, Cold War secrecy concerns inadvertently split the way fusion research worked in the United States. Now, at that same time, Soviet tokamaks were being revealed to the world's assembled physicists in Geneva. American and Soviet diplomats were negotiating a temporary halt of nuclear weapons testing and a moratorium that would last until 1961. So now with their regular regimen of testing hydrogen bombs on pause, Alex Wellerstein, he's a historian of physics and nuclear secrecy at the Stevens Institute of Technology, he explains that the various laboratories in the United States had to pivot their work. If you're not allowed to test, then you really screw things up. Instead, physicists were reassigned to various related questions, including a young physicist named John Knuckles. Knuckles was set to find the answer to a straightforward question, with America considering using nuclear bombs to dig out canals or ports and mines. Could you set off a nuclear bomb to generate cheap electricity from it? Perhaps, unsurprisingly, he could not. Nuclear weapons are expensive, uranium is expensive, and the easiest way to do it still would generate a massive plume of radioactive steam. But it set Knuckles down a path. What if you got rid of the uranium? What if you got rid of fission that causes the radiation? To do that, Wellerstein explains that physicists turned to another brand new invention, the laser. Enough laser, Knuckles realized, could be used to replicate the inside of a hydrogen bomb, compressing and heating a tiny pellet of fuel and causing fusion. This, however, is much easier said than done. Over 60 years ago, Knuckles decided to try solving this problem by shifting focus from hitting a tiny pellet with many powerful lasers, which was known as the direct drive approach, to hitting a slightly larger radioactive container that distributes energy into the fuel pellet in an indirective approach. That NIF used to achieve this breakthrough ignition that we're just talking about. In 1961, all this was put on hold, and American physicists went back to applying these techniques to weapons as the Kennedy administration resumed tests on nuclear weapons. And by the late 1960s, though other people, according to Wellerstein, were starting to figure out that things at the end of the laser get very hot, ex-nuclear weapons physicist Keith Bruckner began filing patents on a very optimistic version of a laser-driven fusion, leading to the declassification of Knuckles' earliest work in the 1970s. But eventually Bruckner's company, KMS Fusion, fell apart after some success, but much less success than he had promised. Now, Wellerstein says that the early 70s ideas about making power plants out of this involve this being a lot easier than it actually is. The National Ignition Facility has to be carefully tended and adjusted in order to feed a football field's worth of laser energy into a tiny pellet. But they wouldn't involve shooting off many of those shots per minute, almost like an internal combustion engine. So that's just kind of where the development of nuclear bomb technology coincided with the development of, could we just create cheap electricity from now all this knowledge that we have to create these tremendously powerful weapons for the battlefield. And that's kind of how fusion all got started, just a little history. It's fascinating, I think, that, for example, I'm looking at my iPhone over here on my desk. The iPhone, I'm just going to throw out a number. I would wager that the majority of its most basic components, like GPS, for example, that you have in your phone, you pull up Apple Maps, Google Maps, boom, you right know where your GPS is and tells you where your location is, where you want to go, right? That technology came from military hardware, the technology that allowed missiles to be directed to a very specific point. What I'm trying to get at is, whether it's fusion energy, GPS, or other things, so much technology that we appreciate just as civilians in the commercial realm was created and initiated in national security and national defense. So just an interesting side note. So we've gone through the recent breakthrough in fusion energy, a little bit about the history, where it comes from. Now that we have this kind of understanding, what are some of the geopolitical ramifications to come? Or really, just how do we set the table, so to speak, of what are our countries doing and what will this kind of affect fossil fuel development for other countries and et cetera, and obviously the natural biases that we've had as a people towards nuclear energy, given that we think of nuclear, we immediately think of a devastating bomb. So let's just go through this a little bit here. And this is a reporting according to the European Institute of International Law, and saying that since nuclear fission, and most likely fusion power plants, have a long life cycle spanning about 60 to 80 years, the rising influence of nuclear energy on geopolitical relationships cannot be ignored. With the need of close collaboration to maintain such plants, partnering countries are locked into and tight relations, a tactic seen favorably by Beijing. As such, China's push into nuclear and renewable energy is more related to geopolitics and its own energy security. In the Chinese Communist Party's mouthpiece, The People's Daily, fusion has been clearly named the, quote, way to solve China's strategic energy needs, end quote. So the rift between the United States and China, becoming clearer and clearer, raises the possibility of disruption of large international projects. In particular, ITER, which stands for the International Thermonuclear Experimental Reactor. This is a project that about 35 countries are participating in. So one example could be Additionally, the U.S.-China trade war. You know, when you've got former President Donald Trump revoked a cooperation of an American company with a Chinese state-owned company to construct an experimental nuclear reactor in China, agreed to under his predecessor, Barack Obama. Further restrictions have been implemented on civilian nuclear technology transfers to China from the United States in 2018. During the last administration's term, the U.S. State Department pointed out that China uses its nuclear industry to increase its national power through the development for civilian use and to support its military buildup. There is also a growing reluctance of Western countries to cooperate with China, as numerous incidences of Chinese espionage have made the former distrustful of Beijing stealing their technologies. A breakdown of scientific cooperation and a worsening political climate may lead to the collapse of fusion-related intellectual property rights, a nightmare for private companies heavily invested in the technology. What needs to be taken into account, furthermore, is that the potential to disrupt fossil fuel-based economies, form the global south, and upending intra-regional energy agreements there. Let me just tease out something for a bit on that very last point about what needs to be taken into account. So, whenever you hear the term global north, global south, forgive me if you already know this, but typically what that's referring to is global north. Think about your developed Western countries, United States, Western Europe, Australia, New Zealand, etc. Global South typically refers to what we used to call the third world or just developing countries. And that's just a distinction. I just wanted to make sure we understood those terms. What this point is making here, it's what taking into account this potential disruption of fossil fuel-based economies. So the Global South, also known as third world, developing countries, etc., depend greatly on fossil fuels to develop their economies, much like the Western countries did in the Industrial Revolution and until now, for that matter. There's actually an article written, and forgive me, I think it was the president of Uganda, if I'm not mistaken, and it was writing to either New York Times or Wall Street Journal. This is a couple of years ago. And basically said that the developing world, or the Global South, was not going to stop using fossil fuels to enhance their economies just to please like Western climate change advocates and their goals for the planet. They just weren't going to do it, pointing out that the only way that Western countries reached their developed economies was the benefit of fossil fuels. So I just wanted to highlight a couple of distinctions on that last point. So in sum, the significance of fusion power for geopolitics has been underestimated by the West because fossil fuels have been cheaper. A growing public distrust of nuclear energy after the Fukushima disaster in 2010 has moved renewables to the center, held as the white knight of a future energy supply. Now, China, and to a lesser degree Russia, play the nuclear energy game for the long term, seeking for openings in places like Africa, Asia, South America, Middle East, or even Europe. So with that outline of geopolitical concerns being made, as well as now we've talked about the breakthrough in the history of fusion energy, I think, and not having a science background, any to claim, I think this development is absolutely tremendous, but because it essentially allows, as I understand it, the capacity to harness fusion energy, something that we were only able to essentially create massive destructive weapons in the past. Now we can harness that energy to push it into something, whether that's to fuel a city or to fuel a car one day or fuel a home. That's essentially like our end goal, right? However, let me just speak of the gap of where we are right now to where we could be in the upcoming decades. Now that the science has been proven, hey, this actually works, now you've got the engineering issue, right? You've got the engineers going, great, you know how to harness fusion energy. How do I make that applicable to the end customer, right? The city, the guy driving the new vehicle, etc. That's what is right there, the issue that engineers face right now. And that issue, that's not going to be fixed like in 12 or 24 months. I mean, unless some brilliant engineer comes up with something and able to harness this whole thing. But as I understand it, and I mean the reporting I read earlier, 50 to 60 years for at least those massive power plants is kind of the timeline to adopt a new type of energy. So, let's see, I'm 35. So, at the end of my lifetime, we could see fusion energy plants powering massive cities. Obviously, a tremendous breakthrough and moving a great direction, but I just want to point that out. last comment on this subject is the geopolitical implications. I think whether it's fusion energy, renewables of any other kind, fossil fuels for that matter, you've heard me talk about this before. The greatest human need is the need of security, right? Knowing what is familiar, knowing that someone is secure. I mean, that's the most basic thing at your existence. And that starts making sure you have food, shelter, your family secure. Okay, those basic tenets are met. Great. Now it's got to be on to the community, my town, my neighborhood, my state, my country. You know, you get where I'm going here. So think about that concept when we're thinking about energy resources. There will always be a desire for energy resources. Right now, this breakthrough has happened here in the United States, like many breakthroughs in technology. That is a resource, that breakthrough, that knowledge is a resource, and it will not be long until advanced other nation states will attempt to steal that technology, whether it's overtly over time or via more covert methods. That is the resource at this moment, is that scientific breakthrough. Fusion is a nothing new, but it's how they make it. That's that resource. So whether we're competing for oil or some other type of geothermals, lithiums, you know, precious metals, you name it, there will always be a competition for it, because ultimately the human need to secure itself extends to the nation state, because the nation state isn't made up of individuals who all are driven by the same thing, essentially, at the end of the day. I hope you found this as interesting as I did, and certainly going to keep an eye on how this thing progresses, though I suspect it will take quite a bit of many years before we see some kind of commercial application that could benefit you or I just living our lives as average everyday Americans. As always, I hope you are picking up what I'm putting down. Again, Merry Christmas to everyone. Hope you have a tremendous time and holidays with your family and friends. I am Matt Parker. This is Brief Before Impact.